Chapter 3. Following the ominous oncoming of a tropical night, I could not have told him that Nina had said, "It has set at last." He would have been extremely surprised, and perhaps have dropped his precious banjo. Neither could I have told him that the sun of my seagoing was setting too, even as I wrote the words expressing the impatience of passionate youth bent on its desire. I did not know this myself, and it is safe to say he would not have cared, though he was an excellent young fellow, and treated me with more deference than, in our relative positions, I was strictly entitled to. He lowered a tender gaze on his banjo, and I went on looking through the porthole. The round opening framed in its brass rim a fragment of the quays, with a row of casks ranged on the frozen ground, and the tail end of a great cart. A red-nosed carter in a blouse, and a woolen nightcap leaned against the wheel. An idle, strolling custom house guard, belted over his blue capote, had the air of being depressed by exposure to the weather, and the monotony of official existence. The background of grimy houses found a place in the picture framed by my porthole, across a wide stretch of paved quay brown with frozen mud. The coloring was somber, and the most conspicuous feature was a little cafe with curtained windows, and a shabby front of white woodwork, corresponding with the squalor of these poorer quarters bordering the river. We had been shifted down there from another berth in the neighborhood of the Opera House, where that same porthole gave me a view of quite another sort of cafe, the best in the town, I believe, and the very one where the worthy Bovary and his wife, the romantic daughter of old Pierre Renault, had some refreshment after the memorable performance of an opera which was the tragic story of Lucia di Lammermoor in a setting of light music. I could recall no more the hallucination of the Eastern Archipelago which I certainly hoped to see again. The story of Almayer's folly got put away under the pillow for that day. I do not know that I had any occupation to keep me away from it. The truth of the matter is that on board that ship we were leading just then a contemplative life. I will not say anything of my privileged position. I was there us to oblige, as an actor of standing may take a small part in the benefit performance of a friend. As far as my feelings were concerned, I did not wish to be in that steamer at that time and in those circumstances. And perhaps I was not even wanted there in the usual sense in which a ship wants an officer. It was the first and last instance in my sea life when I served ship owners who have remained completely shadowy to my apprehension. I do not mean this for the well-known firm of London shipbrokers which had chartered the ship to the, I will not say short-lived, but ephemeral Franco-Canadian Transport Company. A death leaves something behind, but there was never anything tangible left from the FCTC. It flourished no longer than roses live, and unlike the roses it blossomed in the dead of winter, emitted a sort of faint perfume of adventure, and died before spring set in. But indubitably it was a company, it had even a house flag, all white with the letters FCT. C artfully tangled up in a complicated monogram. We flew it at our mainmast head, and now I have come to the conclusion that it was the only flag of its kind in existence. All the same, we on board, for many days, had the impression of being a unit of a large fleet with fortnightly departures for Montreal and Quebec as advertised in pamphlets and prospectuses which came aboard in a large package in Victoria Dock, London, just before we started for Rouen, France. And in the shadowy life of the FCT. See lies the secret of that, my last employment in my calling, which in a remote sense interrupted the rhythmical development of Nina Almayer's story. The then secretary of the London Shipmasters Society, with its modest rooms in Fenchurch Street, was a man of indefatigable activity and the greatest devotion to his task. He is responsible for what was my last association with a ship. I call it that because it can hardly be called a seagoing experience. Dear Captain Froude, it is impossible not to pay him the tribute of affectionate familiarity at this distance of years at very sound views, as to the advancement of knowledge and status for the whole body of the officers of the mercantile marine. He organized for us courses of professional lectures, St. John ambulance classes, corresponded industriously with public bodies and members of Parliament on subjects touching the interests of the service, and as to the oncoming of some inquiry or commission relating to matters of the sea and to the work of seamen, it was a perfect godsend to his need of exerting himself on our corporate behalf. Together with this high sense of his official duties, he had in him a vein of personal kindness, a strong disposition to do what good he could to the individual members of that craft, of which in his time he had been a very excellent master. And what greater kindness can one do to a seaman than to put him in the way of employment? Captain Froude did not see why the Shipmasters' Society, besides its general guardianship of our interests, should not be unofficially an employment agency of the very highest class. I am trying to persuade all our great ship-owning firms to come to us for their men. There is nothing of a trade union spirit about our society, and I really don't see why they should not, he said once to me. Amal was telling the captains too, that, all things being equal, they ought to give preference to the members of the society. In my position I can generally find for them what they want among our members or our associate members. In my wanderings about London from west to east, and back again, I was very idle then. The two little rooms in Fenchurch Street were a sort of resting place where my spirit, hankering after the sea, could feel itself nearer to the ships, the men, and the life of its choice nearer there than on any other spot of the solid earth. This resting place used to be, at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, full of men and tobacco smoke, but Captain Froude had the smaller room to himself, and there he granted private interviews, whose principal motive was to render service. Thus, one murky November afternoon he beckoned me in with a crooked finger, and that peculiar glance above his spectacles which is perhaps my strongest physical recollection of the man. I have had in here a shipmaster, this morning, he said, getting back to his desk and motioning me to a chair, who is in want of an officer. It's for a steamship. You know, nothing pleases me more than to be asked, but, unfortunately, I do not quite see my way. As the outer room was full of men, I cast a wondering glance at the closed door, but he shook his head. Oh, yes, I should be only too glad to get that berth for one of them. But the fact of the matter is, the captain of that ship wants an officer who can speak French fluently, and that's not so easy to find. I do not know anybody myself but you. It's a second officer's berth, and, of course, you would not care. Would you now? I know that it isn't what you are looking for. It was not. I had given myself up to the idleness of a haunted man who looks for nothing but words wherein to capture his visions. But I admit that outwardly I resembled sufficiently a man who could make a second officer for a steamer chartered by a French company. I showed no sign of being haunted by the fate of Nina, and by the murmurs of tropical forests, and even my intimate intercourse with Elmer, a person of weak character, had not put a visible mark upon my features. For many years he and the world of his story had been the companions of my imagination without, I hope, impairing my ability to deal with the realities of sea life. I had had the man and his surroundings with me ever since my return from the eastern waters some 4 years before the day of which I speak. It was in the front sitting room of furnished apartments, in the Pimlico Square, that they first began to live again with a vividness and poignancy quite foreign to our former real intercourse. I had been treating myself to a long stay on shore, and in the necessity of occupying my morning's Elmer, that old acquaintance came nobly to the rescue. Before long, as was only proper, his wife and daughter joined him round my table, and then the rest of that pantai band came full of words and gestures. Unknown to my respectable landlady, it was my practice directly after my breakfast to to hold animated receptions of Malays, Arabs, and half-castes. They did not clamor aloud for my attention. They came with a silent and irresistible appeal, and the appeal, I affirm here, was not to my self-love or my vanity. It seems now to have had a moral character, for why should the memory of these beings, seen in their obscure, sun-bathed existence, demand to express itself in the shape of a novel, except on the ground of that mysterious fellowship which unites in a community of hopes and fears all the dwellers on this earth? I did not receive my visitors with boisterous rapture as the bearers of any gifts of profit or fame. There was no vision of a printed book before me as I sat writing at that table, situated in a decayed part of Bulgravia. After all these years, each leaving its evidence of slowly blackened pages, I can honestly say that it is a sentiment akin to pity which prompted me to render in words assembled with conscientious care the memory of things far distant, and of men who had lived. But, coming back to Captain Froude and his fixed idea of never disappointing ship owners or ship captains, it was not likely that I should fail him in his ambition to satisfy at a few hours' notice the unusual demand for a French-speaking officer. He explained to me that the ship was chartered by a French company intending to establish a regular monthly line of sailings from Rouen for the transport of French emigrants to Canada. But, frankly, this sort of thing did not interest me very much. I said gravely that, if it were really a matter of keeping up the reputation of the Shipmasters' Society, I would consider it. But the consideration was just for form's sake. The next day I interviewed the captain, and I believe we were impressed favorably with each other. He explained that his chief mate was an excellent man in every respect, and that he could not think of dismissing him so as to give me the higher position, but that if I consented to come as second officer I would be given certain special advantages and so on. I told him that, if I came at all, the rank really did not matter. "I am sure," he insisted, "you will get on first rate with Mr. Paramore." I promised faithfully to stay for two trips at least, and it was in those circumstances that what was to be my last connection with a ship began. And after all, there was not even one single trip. It may be that it was simply the fulfillment of a fate, of that written word on my forehead which apparently forbade me, through all my sea wanderings, ever to achieve the crossing of the Western Ocean using the words in that special sense in which sailors speak of Western Ocean trade, of Western Ocean packets, of Western Ocean hard cases. The new life attended closely upon the old, and the 9 chapters of Lemaire's Folly went with me to the Victoria Dock, whence in a few days we started for Rouen. I won't go so far as saying that the engaging of a man fated never to cross the Western Ocean was the absolute cause of the Franco-Canadian Transport Company's failure to achieve even a single passage. It might have been that, of course. But the obvious, gross obstacle was clearly the want of money. 460 bunks for emigrants were put together in the tween decks by industrious carpenters, while we lay in the Victoria Dock, but never an emigrant turned up in Rouen, of which, being a humane person, I confess I was glad. Some gentlemen from Paris, I think there were 3 of them, and one was said to be the chairman, turned up, indeed, and went from end to end of the ship, knocking their silk hats cruelly against the deck beams. I attended them personally, and I can vouch for it, that the interest they took in things was intelligent enough, though, obviously, they had never seen anything of the sort before. Their faces as they went ashore wore a cheerfully inconclusive expression. Notwithstanding that this inspecting ceremony was supposed to be a preliminary to immediate sailing, it was then, as they filed down our gangway, that I received the inward monition that no sailing within the meaning of our charter party would ever take place. It must be said that in less than 3 weeks a move took place. When we first arrived, we had been taken up with much ceremony well toward the center of the town, and all the street corners being placarded with the tricolor posters announcing the birth of our company. The petit bourgeois with his wife and family made a Sunday holiday from the inspection of the ship. I was always in evidence in my best uniform to give information, as though I had been a Cook's tourist's interpreter, while our quartermasters reaped a harvest of small change from personally conducted parties. But when the move was made, that move which carried us a mile and a half down the stream, to be tied up to an altogether muddier and shabbier quay, then indeed the desolation of solitude became our lot. It was a complete and soundless stagnation, for as we had the ship ready for sea to the smallest detail, as the frost was hard, and the days short, we were absolutely idle to the point of blushing with shame, when the thought struck us that all the time our salaries went on. Young Cole was aggrieved because, as he said, we could not enjoy any sort of fun in the evening, after loafing like this all day. Even the banjo lost its charm, since there was nothing to prevent his strumming on it all the time between the meals. The good paramour, he was really a most excellent fellow, became unhappy as far as was possible to his cheery nature, till one dreary day I suggested, out of sheer mischief, that he should employ the dormant energies of the crew in hauling both cables up on deck, and turning them end for end. For a moment Mr. Paramour was radiant. Excellent idea. But directly his face fell. Hi. Yes. But we can't make that job last more than 3 days, he muttered, discontentedly. I don't know how long he expected us to be stuck on the riverside outskirts of Rouen, but I know that the cables got hauled up and turned end for end according to my satanic suggestion. Put down again, and their very existence utterly forgotten, I believe, before a French river pilot came on board, to take our ship down, empty as she came, into the Havre roads. You may think that this state of forced idleness favored some advance in the fortunes of Almayer and his daughter. Yet it was not so. As if it were some sort of evil spell, my banjoist cabin mate's interruption, as related above, had arrested them short at the point of that fateful sunset for many weeks together. It was always thus with this book, begun in 89 and finished in 94 with that shortest of all the novels which it was to be my lot to write. Between its opening exclamation calling Almayer to his dinner in his wife's voice, and Abdullah's, his enemy, mental reference to the God of Islam, be merciful, the compassionate which closes the book, there were to come several long sea passages, a visit, to use the elevated phraseology suitable to the occasion, to the scenes, some of them, of my childhood, and the realization of childhood's vain words, expressing a light-hearted and romantic whim. It was in 1868, when 9 years old or thereabouts, that while looking at a map of Africa of the time, and putting my finger on the blank space then representing the unsolved mystery of that continent, I said to myself, with absolute assurance and an amazing audacity which are no longer in my character now, when I grow up I shall go there. And of course I thought no more about it till after a quarter of a century or so an opportunity offered to go there, as if the sin of childish audacity were to be visited on my mature head. Yes, I did go there. There being the region of Stanley Falls, which in 68 was the blankest of blank spaces on the Earth's figured surface. And the MS of Almayer's Folly, carried about me, as if it were a talisman or a treasure, went there too. That it ever came out of there seems a special dispensation of Providence, because a good many of my other properties. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.